welcome to another edition of Warrior Connection. Again, today and everything else we come to making sure the veteran can thrive in their life after the military. Today's December 7th when we're pre-recording this. It's an important day in history. Ray, are you there today?
I am, Doug, and I agree with you about this day. It's truly a day of infamy, as it was always said, and it's just an honor to be with you today.
Well, I mean, thank you very much. I mean, we've just had an election, and this election, it seems like, has turned a lot of things topsy-turvy. We're seeing friendships are being dissolved and broken up. People are arguing amongst themselves. We're seeing a lot of demonstrations. And for me, it's frightening because, you know, the election outcome is as it is, and the voice of the American people have decided. We have a new president that's president-elect. Obama and his cohorts will be growing out, so there's going to be a lot of changes. So it seems to me, and I think hopefully you're in agreement, all we can do now is make a decision to help everything go forward, find out what do we need to improve the life of all the veterans and everybody in our nation, and work towards achieving that goal. Don't you think so?
I really do. And, Doug, I hear it asked quite often, especially in the church circles. Someone will say, complain about the president-elect or whatever, and someone will say, well, have you prayed for him? It's like, no, not really. Well, maybe we ought to do that. You know, maybe we ought to come together under the banner of God, all of us, and just say, let's pray. Because, Doug, there's a lot of situations, and you and I know from military, we don't know what we're going to do until we get into it. We can talk about it, but until you've been in it, you really don't know. So our future right now is unknown, but there is a known God will help us get through this thing if we want to.
I think that's really critical because I think, you know, the thing is, it's over, it's done, the election is done with. There's a lot of events that happened in the past. We can't change the past. The only thing we can do is learn from the past and make a decision to consciously improve the lives of all the veterans and everybody in our nation. And I think that's what we have to do now. And the new leadership, hopefully they'll lead us in that direction. If they start leading us astray, then I think it's up for us to pull it back into a common sense mode of God, nation, and morality, and everything else. I mean, something's got to be done because it's been totally out of control. I mean, that's my own impression.
Well, it is to me also, and I think I would give a suggestion to Hillary and Donald Trump. You know, Solomon said, a fool is known by his many words. And I guess for both people up in political circles like that, don't say too much. Don't just spill your guts every time you get opportunity, because you're giving people a chance to really criticize where there is nothing to talk about, really. Just hold your peace and let's get this thing done, you know?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, that's really important. Again, we've put the recommendations out on this radio show before as to what the VA needs to do and how they can improve care. I mean, it's a daily fight. I mean, I know myself, I'm continually having problems trying to get proper care, and they don't want to look at the information. They don't want to share it. They don't want to go out there and do their homework. And that's got to change. And it doesn't matter who's in charge or who's number one, because the needs are going to remain the same, aren't they?
Well, they are, and if you get the right people in there, they might have a vision or some clarity. And I do say, and I believe it's a real power, and I believe that it's a source that many of us don't use, but many of us do use, and it is the power of prayer, of asking God to help this person to do what's right or give them clarity in what they want to do. And then what you have to do is just trust God and support people in their positions. And I mean, wait until they mess up, and then we can jump on them. But for the time being, we need to get together on this thing. Someone said one time, Doug, we came into this country in all different kind of ships, but today we're all in the same boat, and we got to figure this thing out.
I think that's real important. Well, speaking about the boat and being the ship, today is December 7th. Obviously, it's a historical day in history. For me, December 7th is the day that I originally enlisted and went on active duty for the first time with the U.S. Air Force back in 1967. And I essentially selected that day to do that because, again, my dad was in World War II. Was your dad in World War II, Ray?
He was a merchant marine. He was on the ships taking supplies to Europe. So he was a civilian, but yet he was part of the war effort.
That's a very dangerous job there because of all the German torpedo boats and everything out there in the Atlantic, definitely taking everybody out all over the place. Well, December 7th, 1941, I guess what it is, the day that I'll live in infamy, as Roosevelt said in his speech that next morning. But early Sunday morning in December. Hawaii obviously is a tropical climate, so completely different than our winter climate back here in North America, but continental U.S. But that whole day led into an incredible period of time, and I don't think anybody can ever forget that. I mean, those of us who were born shortly afterward, those who were born before, those who were born during, and all of those that were affected in that day. I mean, this marked a change in life, didn't it?
It really did. And, you know, in those days back in 1941, we were actually, our military, we think of a massive military, United States, but we were number 14th in military worldwide. We were behind Sweden when it came to our military. And so they put the Pacific Fleet at Hawaii. I mean, this was all the balls in the court right there. And it really, it became a mistake, but, you know, it really, I think it really brought out the true American in people, and they wanted to, you know, back the war effort and everything. So I think it really brought a country together. Sometimes the worst experiences, just like 9/11, it made the country come back together and realize that we have a God, too, and we've got to do better than what we're doing, and it helps us to refocus our lives and our minds and our hearts. And I think that's what happened on December 7th, Doug, is that America woke up.
Well, you know, as Tojo said, and we've seen this in the movies and it's reported in the history books, after the attack, I think he said that he realized all he did was waking up a sleeping giant and fill him with a terrible resolve. And I think that has proven to be a fact and everything because, I mean, the war went on. Our parents were involved in it, you know, and I had older cousins, you know, that were around there. I just talked to one of my cousins a few minutes ago. We went to have lunch together working on the garage door. He was about 10, 11 years old when all this happened, and he was old enough to really understand what had transpired. And that day is 75 years ago or something like that, isn't it? I mean, I lost track of the years.
It is. I had an Uncle Fred that was at Pearl Harbor that day and on a ship, and he was shot in the back by a machine gun, but he survived anyway. But he was one of the casualties that day. So it was a terrible day. The thing about it is, Doug, we didn't have the mass media that we have today. So they didn't have all the information in the States that was actually going on. And the battle had ended, but they were still thinking it was continued on throughout that day. But had they had the information we have today, I don't know how it would have been worse or even better, but I'm not sure. But it was a horrendous day for America.
Well, you know, we started out after World War One with the treaties and everything, Treaty of Versailles and all that stuff set everything up. Obviously, World War Two was set up, and that was going to happen. But when the Japanese and then the Italians and the Germans all went together at that time, and obviously there was a lot of shenanigans going on all over, a lot of political intrigue between all the nations and what is going on. But, you know, one thing that's always talked about on December 7th, and I've heard this from day one in my history in my days in the military, is the question is, how much did they know what's going to happen or anything? Well, it doesn't really matter at all today if they knew or what it didn't. We had a horrific sudden attack on the American fleet. Thank God the carriers were not in there in Pearl Harbor on that morning, just as church services were beginning to happen. I guess it's what 7:55 or 8 o'clock in the morning?
Yeah.
So that's, I mean, that's almost exactly, 5 hours to the hour right now.
Sure.
You know, when this all took place. It is 75 years ago, isn't it?
It's 75 years. And the thing about 8 o'clock in the morning or 7:55, Doug, if you read military books on about your enemies, know your enemies, such things, I remember they used to talk about Russia because alcohol was so prevalent in the military, vodka especially, and the weekends were so prevalent with partying and drinking and all this stuff. They said the best time to hit your the Russian army back then, you know, like 20 years ago, they said would be about 4 o'clock Monday morning because they're all hungover and they just can't function in their normal state of defense. And I suppose that's why they hit Pearl Harbor on Sunday morning at 7 o'clock or 7:55 in the morning. It's because they knew Saturday night would be a party night in Hawaii. And I know that sounds a little off-center a little bit, but it is true. And when you're talking about hitting your enemy, you always find his vulnerabilities, and then you go and act on those vulnerabilities. And that could have been having something to do with us. Sunday morning is a day that we take rest, and we're just laid back. And they knew Americans. They know all of our vulnerabilities. After World War One, it was supposed to have been the war that ended all wars. And I think America really hoped that was the truth. And so we allowed things to relax after World War One, and we didn't want to fight anybody. We wanted to stay out of the European war. And so the Japanese were against the wall economically, and a lot of, they've been in war for several years with China and different places. And I guess it was just a powder keg, and they decided to try to knock us out with one punch. And that's what happened.
Well, I've gone onto the websites for Pearl Harbor and everything else, and this was a sequence of events about those days. And just some reading, this is a direct quotation. Saturday, December 6th, Washington, D.C., U.S. President Franklin Roosevelt makes a final appeal to the Emperor of Japan for peace. There is no reply. Late the same day, the U.S. code-breaking service begins intercepting the 14-part Japanese message and deciphers the first 13 parts, passing them on to the President and the Secretary of State. The Americans believe a Japanese attack is imminent, most likely somewhere in Southeast Asia. Sunday, December 7th, Washington, D.C., the last part of the Japanese message stating the diplomatic relations with the U.S. are to be broken off, reaches Washington in the morning and is decoded at approximately 9 a.m. About an hour later, another Japanese message is intercepted and instructs the Japanese embassy to deliver the main message to the Americans at 1 p.m. The Americans realize this time corresponds with early morning time in Pearl Harbor, which is several hours behind. U.S. War Department sends out an alert, but uses a commercial telegraph because radio contact with Hawaii is temporarily broken. Delays prevent the alert from arriving at headquarters in Oahu until noontime, Hawaii time, 4 hours after the attack has already begun. Sunday, December 7th, the islands of Hawaii near Oahu, the Japanese attack force under the command of Admiral Nagumo, consisting of 6 carriers with 423 planes, is about to attack. At 6 a.m., the first wave of 183 Japanese planes takes off from the carriers located 230 miles north of Oahu and heads for the U.S. Pacific Fleet at Pearl Harbor. Pearl Harbor at 7:02 a.m., two Army operators at Oahu's Northern Shore Radar Station detect Japanese aircraft air attack approaching and contact junior officer who disregards their reports, thinking they are the American B-17 planes, which are expected in from the U.S. West Coast. As we do know, those B-17s landed in the middle of the battle, in the middle of the attack. Near Oahu at 7:15 a.m., a second attack wave of 167 planes takes off from Japanese carriers and heads from Pearl Harbor. Pearl Harbor is not on a state of high alert. Senior commanders have concluded, based on available intelligence, there is no reason to believe an attack is imminent. Aircraft, therefore, are parked wingtip to wingtip on the airfields, and aircraft guns are unmanned, with many ammunition boxes kept locked in accordance with peacetime regulations. There are also no torpedo nets protecting the fleet anchorage. And since it is Sunday morning, many officers and crewmen are leisurely ashore. 7:53 a.m., the first Japanese assault wave with 51 Val dive bombers, 40K torpedo bombers, 50 high-level bombers, and 43 Zero fighters commences the attack with the fight commander, Mashito Fushidi, sounding the battle cry, Tora, Tora, Torga. English means tiger, tiger, tiger. The Americans are taken completely by surprise. First attack wave targets airfields and battleships. Second wave targets other ships and shipyard facilities. Their raid lasts until 9:45 a.m. 8 battleships are damaged, but 5 sunk. 3 light cruisers, 3 destroyers, and 3 smaller vessels are lost, along with 188 aircraft. The Japanese lose 27 planes and 5 midget submarines, which attempted to penetrate the inner harbor and launch torpedoes. Escape and damage from the attack are the prime targets. The 3 U.S. Pacific Fleet aircraft carriers, the Lexington, the Enterprise, and the Saratoga, which were not in port. Also escaping damage are the base fuel tanks. Casualty list includes 2,335 servicemen, 68 civilians killed, 1,178 wounded, included our 1,104 men aboard the battleship U.S. Arizona, killed after a 1,760-pound air bomb penetrating the forward magazine, causes catastrophic explosions. In Washington, various delays prevent the Japanese diplomats from sending the warm message to Secretary of State Cordell Hill until 2:30 p.m. Washington time, just as the first reports of the air raid at Pearl Harbor are being read by Hull. News of a sneak attack is broadcast to the American public via radio bulletins, with many popular Sunday afternoon entertainment programs being interrupted. The news sends a shockwave across the nation, results in tremendous influx of volunteers into U.S. Armed Forces. The attack also unites the nation behind the President Roosevelt and effectively ends isolationism, sentiment in the country. December 8th, the United States and Britain declare war on Japan, with President Roosevelt calling December 7th a date that will live in infamy. Thursday, December 11th, Germany and Italy declare war on the United States. The European and Southeast Asia wars have now become a global conflict, with the Axis powers, Japan, Germany, Italy, united against America, Britain, France, and other allies. Wednesday, December 17th, Admiral Chester Nimitz becomes the new commander of the U.S. Pacific Fleet. Both senior commanders at Pearl Harbor, Navy Admiral Husband E. Kimmel and Army Lieutenant Walter Short, were relieved of their duties following the attack. Subsequent investigations will fault the men for failing to adopt adequate defense measures. End quote.
Yeah, you know, I think that what they did was, is that the commanders thought that most of the attack would come from terrorists on the island itself. So they put those planes wing to wing, and they made a lot. That was their defense, was to defend the island against invasion, not know it's going to come from the air. So what they did was they made a perfect target for those planes, because the planes were stacked together and everything was put there. And so instead of being defensive as far as an enemy attacking, they tried to specialize into it. And whenever you do that, Doug, you always get in trouble. You have to be flexible, and you have to listen to other people. And you have to get hold of some of the people that may know certain aspects of battle that you may not be familiar with. And that's what they should have done. I think America was just really blindsided on this thing. And they thought neutrality is a way to peace, but sometimes it's not. You know, they say many times that silence is golden, but many times it's just plain old yellow. What I'm saying about that, we weren't yellow by any means. But I'm saying sometimes you can be neutral, but you can keep your eyes open. You begin to defend yourself in many ways. Today they tell people with cameras and cell phones, if you see anything suspicious, take a picture, send it, call 911, do something. But just don't walk around with our heads, you know, in the skies, or, you know, like an ostrich in the ground. But be vigilant. And I think we lacked vigilance in those days, and we paid for it.
You know, and I think a lesson learned, because, you know, we had this event at Ohio State, and we've had all these military attacks. I'm not going to call them terrorists, talk military attacks throughout the Western world in response to all the military activities and our activities throughout the Middle East and the Far East now for years. And you can't take one action and not expect a consequent action to take place. Right. And when we look at Pearl Harbor, I mean, look at the number of ships that were in the port there and the losses and the loss of life, it is absolutely staggering. We were just extraordinarily lucky that the fuel depots didn't get destroyed. We're extraordinarily lucky that the aircraft carriers were not in port. Because if we didn't have that, we would have been in deep doo-doo there for quite a while.
They could have really knocked us out had it been a third wave. One of the things, too, Doug, you know, today we're so, we are acknowledged anyway that we have embedded terrorists among us, you know, in America. And that's one of the fears, is that they call them sleeper cells. But even in Oahu that day, there were a lot of Japanese implanted people there that were spies, and they were out there to, you know, take pictures of battleship row, and they were all over the place. And so you have to be cognizant of those things, of realizing your enemy is among you sometimes. and you have to be, you know, vigilant. When you go on some of these bases today, I know at Camp Lejeune, Cherry Point, some of those places like that, you would think security is really lax because they just, they're not, I mean, I guess we're lulled to sleep by peace, and we love peace. We're a peace-loving people, you would think so. And so we just don't want to bother anybody, or we don't want to be bothered. But we don't realize this world is sharpening their swords. When you see a nation in a position like Japan was, I mean, they were fighting the war with China and Manchuria and all these places, and they were running out of natural resources, running out of oil, running out of metal. And so with the United States, we were selling them a lot of metal and such, and they were using it in machinery or arms and things. But all of a sudden, we cut them off. And because we were going to put sanctions on them, cut off their oil, cut off their, the metal and things like that we were sending to them. And so they were up against a wall. We should have recognized that a little bit sooner, but, you know, we didn't. And hopefully we'll learn from that lesson, and we've learned from history to where we might have a safer nation today.
Yeah, that's all we could hope, to learn from the lessons of the past. I mean, obviously, you know, all of us know when we've been there. I mean, I've been to Pearl Harbor myself and aboard the Arizona Memorial. And no matter who you are or what you've done in the military, that's a moving experience. I mean, realizing, you know, well over 1,000 casualties are still, you know, entombed in the Arizona down below there. When you're on the memorial and you're walking across that beautiful white memorial that straddles the battleship, you can't help but think and realize what was going on. And as it had in the paper today, there's just a handful of these individuals who survived that are left alive today. I mean, you're considering most everybody was around that day. They were 20, 21 years old in 1941. They're now in their 90s, the very few that are left alive. You know, and obviously it's a good day to honor those individuals to remember, you know, what their sacrifices and everything they gave for it, all that stuff.
Well, you know, one of the amazing things, and I'm sure when you cross over that bridge that day, and I've been across it too a couple of different times, but the ship is still bleeding because you look in the water and you see the oil come up to the top and float. There's always that little dribble of oil coming off that ship because they had just filled their tanks up when they were hit. And out of the, let me see, it was on the Arizona itself, I think out of the, let me see how many it was. I was trying to find it. Arizona, well, that day they lost 2,403 men in the battle itself. But, I got it here. But Arizona, out of 1,273 personnel on the Arizona, there's only 96 that lived through it. That's horrendous when you really think about it. And today, that 96, a lot of the 96, when they die today, they have they cremate them and then take their ashes down and put it on the ship because they want to be with their shipmate that died in December 7th, 41. So it is a brotherhood there, Doug, that we know, and it's still going on today.
Yeah, I'm not sure. It's hard to look back today because we were all born right after this event, after our fathers, you know, got back and got out. But all these significant events in history, I mean, for us, we had the Vietnam War and then Desert Storm we got involved in, and the new generation, all this other stuff. But the impact, all this stuff, is going to be the same on everybody, and I think that's part of what we talked about, and the fact that generation upon generation, individuals that have gone through the horrors of war, it's all part of your life, but you can move on. You can survive and you can thrive. You'll never be the same and you'll always be different. I mean, I know talking to my cousin a little while ago, I mean, he was, you know, just old enough to where he could understand what happened that day, but it left an indelible mark, you know, impression and mark on him for his entire life.
Sure it was. The same way 9/11 hits us, you know, and we all identify. I mean, we have televisions now, so it was like being there. And so it does. But the thing about it, too, Doug, is if it had ended in 1945 and America hadn't had any more wars, it would be a different world we live in. But because, like you just said, we've continued to have wars. After World War II ended, We were able to defeat Japan and Germany, and the world went back to peace for a while, but then Korea erupted. And then we went to Korea, and then after Korea was neutralized, then Vietnam started up. And after Vietnam, the Gulf War. And we've been over in the Gulf for 26 years now, I think. And so it's been one thing after another, and America has been all over the world, you know, fighting, I would say, just war sometimes, but then you know the politics of things, and so we don't understand all that. I think to the little guy, it is the old adage of it is not mine to reason why, mine is but to do or die kind of deal. Uh-huh. Because we're Americans, we feel patriotic, we want to participate in the freedom, and I think only about 1%, they say, actually does that. But you have a lot of veterans today that are beaten up. And Pearl Harbor was horrendous, but there's been a lot of horrendous days for a lot of Americans. You know, when a B-52 went down, you lost friends. You lost comrades. When I went through battle sometimes, we lost friends. And that always has that negative effect on you. And you go through life. I often tell when I'm talking to Marines and such, at some of these bases, I go into group therapies and things and speak to them about trying to get their lives back together, that just like you talked before, there is a life. There you can have a good life. You paid for that, actually, and so you need to have that. But you go back in there, and you look in their faces, and they look like they've been beaten up by something. And so you're able to communicate them, there is life after trauma. And I told them yesterday, I was in a group session, and I said, it would really be criminal of me, Doug, to know there is help and hope and me not tell you. And so I said, that's why I'm in there, is to share with them how in the world did we make it this old when we're beaten up so bad. And I think every generation has done that.
You know, there was the chaplain sent this out, and it was on the website. It came in, and quote, this is again on PTSD, accepting emotions helps PTSD recovery. Military medical expert says this is a new story that's just been broken out. And again, this is Dr. Richard Stolz, Deputy Director of Defense Centers for Excellence for Psychological Health and Traumatic Brain Injury. Emotions are incredibly powerful. I mean, whenever we go to war and when we kill or we destroy or we see other friends there that are wounded or injured or they can't get care, the emotions can be overwhelming. And if you try to hide those emotions, whether it be grief or exhilaration, and I think that's the hard thing about with war and battle, Ray, and I think you've been there and you try to describe this in the book, you can be very, very sad and very depressed at the same time. You could feel extraordinary exhilaration in the middle of a war or a battle. I mean, that's a contradictory, but isn't that part of reality of what's happening?
I think so, and I think some people explain it by when there's a big high, just like adrenaline or the battle, there's always a big low. And between every high mountain, there's a valley, you know, and so people come out of a horrendous situation, and they always go into depression. Tomorrow I'm going to work with another group, and it's going to be on moral injury, and last week we had a discussion on that, Doug, and really took them through a class of moral injury, the listeners, because there's a lot of people listening to this show that are coming on there for veterans and other reasons, but I'm telling you, this is for anybody who's ever been traumatized by life, whatever life is. And, you know, we always focus on veterans, but I declare their families and that go through so much stuff, and they're really the unsung heroes. They're usually the ones that you don't recognize, the unknowns. And there's a lot of hurting people out there. So I hope the radio program, Warrior Connection, is, I know it's doing a great job. I do know that. But I hope it's reaching a lot of people to help them to realize just because you've got a bad past, you cannot allow your past to determine your future. You have to go on.
Well, we saw that with the World War II veterans. I mean, you know, they've been labeled the greatest generation. This is our father's group. They went through horrific events. I mean, when I got this new book that looked at labels and I realized this is the ship my father was on, this is where his ship was at. And then you can't even go back and think and try to understand what all transpired. Because for these individuals, and I've talked to various individuals, I mean, we have a perspective from what our fathers and our uncles and others told us. We have a perspective from, like, what my cousin, who was 10 years old, saw at that time. We have a perspective from what we learned in a history book. And then we have a perspective from what we experienced ourselves. I mean, related to this, but separate and different from. And I think one of the things that bothers everything and bothers me, and it's hard to understand, is you can have two individuals at exactly the same location experience exactly the same event and walk away with completely different perceptions and consequences from the event. And I'm not sure why that is or what it entails, but it's something where we just have to accept in reality and move on, I think.
I agree with you with that, but I think the one who moves on and does well should at some point turn around and go get the other guy and show him what he's done. Because we've left everybody, it's like no longer no man left behind. It's more like every man on his own. And I think that's wrong. I think we can go back. You know, I saw a documentary one time, and I think it was Aspen, but it could have been some of the other winter wonderlands out west. And they were talking about up in these ski resorts and all. They were really created by some of the World War II soldiers that were taught to snow because of the battles in Europe and some of the alpine skiers and such. And so they came back home, and yes, they had a lot of problems, but they went ahead and they created land up in the mountains and they created snow resorts. And today they're very wealthy people and families and such. So it does tell you that even though you have a bad past, you can move on and thrive in spite of your past. You know, we always remember Pearl Harbor, but we don't want to get stuck back there. We have to move on at some point. And I thank the Lord that a lot of people have done that, Doug.
Well, I think the other thing, we had the Pearl Harbor, the atrocity there, and then obviously we've all learned and talked to individuals. I've met individuals who survived the Bataan Death March, which was in the Philippines. And, you know, Douglas MacArthur had been ordered out, and he left, and Wainwright ended up surrendering eventually. But all of this came on together. So then when you look at it and you come on back, we ask the question, well, why did the U.S. drop the two nuclear bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki and ended World War II? Well, you can think about it today in the perspective of use of nuclear weapons and what it entails and what this involved, but then you can't judge it on the past, on what we know today. And I think too often we make that mistake where we look at history and we try to make a judgment on what happened before based on what we know and what we have today, and it's totally different.
Well, Doug, I've studied Japanese for 25 years. I've been in martial arts, Okinawan-style martial arts, Japanese-style. So I know a little bit about Japanese history and people and traditions and these type of things. And you have to understand that the Japanese hadn't lost a war in 3,000 years. The Japanese were a most honorable and determined people. They had a lot of heritage. They had a lot of respect for their country. They were very patriotic. Now, if you understand the Japanese at all, some of the armies, they studied something called Bushido. Bushido means way of the warrior. And the way of the warrior has to go with a samurai. And if you've ever studied samurai, well, there's a lot of bad ones, but they did some good things too. But these were vicious soldiers that had no compassion on their enemy at all. They believed that you never give up under any circumstances, and if you do, you're less than human, you deserve to die. And that's why the Japanese on the Bataan Death March and such as that, that's why they were so brutal to the Australians and Americans and different ones that were called to surrender, thinking the war would be over. But their war had just begun because the Japanese despised people who gave up. They were very disciplined. They believed in self-control. They loved simplicity. You know, people think Japan was a third world country. It wasn't. It was an industrial country. But they still had a lot of simplicity within that nation. And that simplicity gave them a little bit of strength that you know, people like in America didn't have, because we're all for self and doing everything ourselves. But Japan was a different kind of country. They loved honor, they loved respect, they loved discipline, they loved self-control, but they hated pride and dishonor and disrespect and undisciplined lifestyle and lack of self-control. They hated arrogance, they hated fear, they hated weakness of any sort, and they didn't like prisoners. And when you fight a nation like that, they said the reason that we use a nuclear bomb because it was the only way to stop the Japanese. We were getting ready to go into Japan, and the coalition's figured on about 1 million casualties because the Japanese people, everybody there was a warrior. Every woman, every child, every man, and they used sticks and brooms and pitchforks and anything they can get their hands on. But when you go in a nation like that, you better have plenty of body bags because they're not going to go down easy if you do. So I do think in that particular situation, the nuclear bomb was a deterrent because you had to deliberately stop the Japanese people because they would have been fighting you to the day if you try to go in their country and whip them. You have to a little bit appreciate for that in kind of integrity. But, it was a bad situation, Doug. And there's a lot of arguing about that, too. But I know a little bit about the Japanese people. And, you know, one of the things we teach us in martial arts, the bottom of everything, the basis of everything we do, you never give up. You always push forward. You adapt, you improvise, and you overcome, but you never quit. And that's one of the messages we have to preach to these people coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan. I know you've been injured. I know you're hurt. You're hurt mentally, emotionally, every other way. A lot of them yesterday, they've lost families, their divorces. Three of these people that I was talking about were deep into substance abuse. I understand. I've been through all that stuff. But I'm telling you, there is a better life, and so that's what we're trying to get them to understand. So it does have its consequences.
Yeah, I think that's important. And again, we've talked about before this, and we learned this afterwards, because at the end of World War II became the GI Bill and the opportunity to get an education and train in vocation or academics, whatever you went into. So you had an entire group that took that and used that opportunity that was created as a result of World War II. Look what we've accomplished. I mean, it's just been astonishing. And then we look at today, so education is the key to the future, is the key to the way out. And one thing they've talked about during this election is making, you know, education free to everybody. Well, if you served in the military and you graduated from high school or GED, you got free education. All you have to do is go out there and get that education. You can go to a vocational education school, you can go to a two-year college or university, go to a four-year college or university, you go to a trade school. But you have that opportunity totally available to you if you just avail yourselves of it. But again, this takes discipline, it takes initiative, and it takes some sacrifice. But without any of that, you're not going to have anything, I don't think. What's worthwhile unless you have to make an effort to get it, and then you have to try the best to get it to work out, don't you?
Well, what I told them yesterday, and I tell them in these classes too, Doug, that I'm looking at these people, and their lives are messed up when they come in these mental health classes, because usually their commanding officers or someone has recommended them to take these classes because they've recognized it. I remember, you read about ancient Rome. When you had killed someone, or it might have been not out-and-out kill them, murder, but it might have been accidentally killing them, or it might have been like what we would consider a car wreck or something, and people would die. What they would do was some of these tyrannic leaders, they would tie a dead body to you, or at least chain him to you, and you had to drag a dead body for a couple weeks around town. You could either drag him, which is hard to do, I mean, like a 150-pound dead body, but then you could have to pick him up and carry them, and they would bloat up, and they would smell terrible, and they would have flies and bugs all over them. They're dead, and you would have to carry them. And this is what I was telling them. I said, you lose all of your friends and all of your family because of the baggage that you've got in your life. And when you've got all this stuff in your life and it's beginning to tear you down, you know, they invite you to a party one night, and so you show up, and there's a lot of friends and family there, but they look at you, and they say, man, you stink. You got a lot of baggage on you. You can come in, but your baggage can't. Well, I relate that to their lifestyle today, that they're developing this death mentality around them, and people avoid it a lot of times. And so we try to get them to understand that you've got to make a step forward. You've got to put the dead stuff down, and you've got to move on, regardless of what has happened in your past, regardless of how many Pearl Harbors you've had in your life. You cannot allow this to stop you. And so we try to motivate them to get them back into school, tech schools, community colleges, preferential schools, whatever they have to do, whatever their goal might be. A lot of them lack a goal, Doug. When they came back from war, just like World War II, there were some of them that lacked motivation because they had been injured so bad emotionally. But a lot of them moved on, and that's where the industrial age really kicked in, was after World War II, was that people began to buy homes and cars, and the government helped them out, and the schools helped them out. And these people, a lot of these people, began to move on. And today, you can see the effects of that. We didn't let it bog us down. We had to keep moving. And that's part of the military training that you received and I received, was you don't ever give up. That's not a good thing. And I think it still works today, Doug.
I think that's an important thing. I guess what I'm thinking on, and we've had this and it'll never end. We all hope and dream and wish there'll never be another Pearl Harbor or 911, but there will be, won't there? I mean,
yeah,
that's
as long
normal
as
part of life, because nations are arguing and fighting amongst each other, looking for territory and resources and control. And it seems no matter what we do or we hope or we pray that it's going to happen again, isn't it?
Well, I think you can look around the world today and you look at China, North Korea, and Iran, and Russia. They're all preparing for war because they never know when it's coming. And then, you know, you go into that offensive mode, but then it turns into defense because you see other people beginning talking about, we're going to build our armies, we're going to be great again, we're going to do this, we're going to do that, we're going to shut you down, we're going to push you back. And then those nations that have been preparing for war, they go from offense to defense. And when you're scared of your enemy and you think there's a chance of your enemy attacking, you have to do what Japan did. You have to do what Israel does. Go after them when they're not expecting it. And so we're looking at nations today that are looking at us real funny and thinking, so you're planning on being the tough guy. And, Doug, so we have to calm some of this rhetoric down, because all we're doing is, you're telling your enemy a lot of things they don't even need to know. And if we would practice a little bit of that and quit being so bold in our language and tough guy. Doug, you and I both have been in combat. And I want to tell you something. The guys who talk the biggest before a battle are the last ones to do anything. Talk is cheap. They want to see what actions are. And usually the hero in the crowd is the quietest one. He is the one that you'd never think he would do anything heroic. And they're the ones that stand up, or they jump on the grenade, or they do this, or they do that. And so it's really, loudmouths really don't do a lot other than take up a lot of air and make a lot of noise. We need to be calmed down as a nation, start rebuilding this thing, and get our focus on peace. Build up a military to have peace. And in doing that, a good defense is a good offense. And so we just need to reconsider what we're saying and just start doing a little bit more.
Yeah, I guess that's just part of life, isn't it?
It is. And I'll tell you something, Doug. When you get your enemy on his knees, just like we were 14th in the, Pearl Harbor, December 7th, we were 14th in military power at that time, behind Sweden, of all places. And so when you see your enemy in a weakened state, your enemy is down on one knee, what do you do as an enemy? Do you let them get up? Do you help them to survive? Do you help them maybe to give them some medications of some type? Do you support them, and do you wait until they get really well, where they get back in your faith, or do you hurt them when they're down on their knee? And I think, especially America right now, because we seem to be so, divided, that's a bad time. We better come together and get our heads on this thing, because our enemy's watching us. And it's a perfect time for somebody to really come and cause a lot of problems. So we have to come together as a nation, or we're going to lose the nation. This division is going to destroy us.
Well,
at least that's the way it's happened in the past.
I'm sitting here reviewing and looking at some of the photographs that we've collected over the years about that day in Pearl Harbor. And the photographs are horrific. It's like the video today. I mean, we have access to so much information, photographs and film and video, and everything that's translated. And people can go and pick it up. But it's hard to even imagine when you're looking at one of the photographs here with these individuals standing there as everything's blowing up around them and people are dying in their fingertips, what it was like. I mean, you can't translate it into words, I don't think. And I think you've tried to do that with your book. I've tried to do it with my writings. We tried to do that as we explained to individuals. But each individual has a complete different perception of what has happened to them, even when the two of them were at exactly the same place at the same time. And then what we've seen is individuals can go on and either collapse or thrive. But that's an individual choice that they have to do with help. They got to seek out that help, though. But then what do we do when we run into the problem where the guy is wounded or injured or sick, and when he goes for help to the VA or the military, and they don't get the medical care that they need?
Well, Doug, we've talked about it in the past many times, is that veterans have to do exactly what we're talking about the nation doing. We got to quit being every man for himself and start taking care of each other. And there's a lot of things that each one of us know that could help another person. I mean, when you coalition things, when you bring them together, when you get people talking, in group therapy, they do it all the time with veterans, and they're trying to get each one of them to open up and spend their guts, because there's other people sitting around you that doesn't have the courage to open up like that. They got all these hidden problems in their life, and it takes somebody to step out and do it first. And when you do that, it's like trying to drink a glass of water or swallow water out of a 5-gallon bucket full of water. You're going to get a face washing, what you're going to do. You're going to wash the whole clothes and everything, because all you're trying to do is get a sip, and all that water is going to dump out on your head. Well, when you do that in a group therapy session, and when somebody begins to spill out a little bit, it's like an overflow. And people began to just weep and cry and spill their guts. That's the purpose in what Charisse March is doing, and Tim Boone and these other folks that are writing this stuff, because they're dipping deep into the dark crevices of their lives, and they're writing, and it doesn't have anything to do with cursing and with foul language. It has to do with the depth of humanity, that when you get in there and you put some light in that dark places of your soul and you begin to write it out, I'm telling you, it has a healing effect for a lot of people. And that's where the veterans can do this type of stuff. We as veterans, Doug, that have been able to get a good life, we have a responsibility and opportunity to turn around to other veterans and say, I want to tell you something that I've learned. And that's what I do all the time, and I know you do the same thing. But we're trying to encourage people who've been wounded to get around some other people who have received healing in their lives. Nobody knows what Charisse has gone through. Nobody really knows what Doug has gone through, or even what you've gone through or I've gone through. We tell them little parts and pieces, but there's a lot more to it. Doug, there's healing out there if we really want it. And there's something down inside every person that does want that healing, and they don't know how to get it. So I think all of us need to reach down inside of ourselves and begin to move forward, and then get somebody else and help them to come forward too.
I think after Pearl Harbor, when I talked to my uncles or my cousins or other family members, they were involved in that. I mean, it was so horrific and everything else that the hatred that it was instilled for the Japanese and the other ones and the Germans, again, the Nazis. And again, this is really strange because with the Japanese and Pearl Harbor, this is also an atrocity. You got the Nazis of the Holocaust, which is, there's no way to even begin to describe that. I think I was 10 years old the first time I saw pictures of it and was told about what it meant and what had transpired. And you sit there and you're aghast, but you don't know until later when you begin to understand. But then where do we search for peace and where do we go to in the future? I mean, there's no doubt at all when we look at the history books, the dropping of the atomic bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki were a large part retribution for the Bataan Death March and Pearl Harbor and all the other actions. But at what point do we move on? At what point do we try and seek peace? Where do we get some tranquility in all this?
Well, one thing I've taught in my martial art classes for years is I try to teach them character, and I get them to read the book of Proverbs about how the humanity and the degradation of humanity and all these things are. A soft answer turns away wrath, but grievous words stir up anger. It takes a big man to humble down sometimes and be nice when you could just throw them out the window. And so it takes a little humility. What I teach them is nobody ever wins a war, Doug. Just one side loses more than the other. And so if you understand that, I mean, how many men and women did we lose in World War II? And I know it, a lot of people in America thought about the consequences and going after them and revenge factor for Pearl Harbor and for Bataan Death March and Tarawa and all these places in Europe. You know, we had a lot of revenge. But I do believe the military people could foresee the devastation that was going to be if we ever went into Japan, because you got to understand the Japanese people. You're not going to go into the Middle East or nowhere else and take it over. That's their home. They're going to fight you like a mad dog. And when people have the disposition and the mentality of a samurai soldier, everybody's a soldier. Everybody. The word karate and the army, the Japanese armies studied karate in World War II. That was part of their training. Karate means empty hand. Kara is empty, te is hand, karate. And so anything becomes a weapon that you pick up with your hand, including your hand. The knuckles, the fingers, the hand, the slice, all these things, that has to do with a weapon. Everything becomes your weapon. The tools that we use in martial arts, that some people call them weapons, they're nothing but foreign tools. Sickles, handle from a corn grinder, a pin that held a yoke of oxen together called a scythe, a stick, a long stick that is called a bow. It's a walking stick. You break it in half, and it makes fighting sticks. I'm just telling you, when you have mentality of a warring nation, and everybody in that nation can grab something, they've been trained somewhat, they know how to throw you down, they know how to use anything around them. And when you put adrenaline with a person that's qualified like that, you got a monster on your hands. So I do believe it was justified to use the weapons we had to end the war, because Japan would have never given up. And, you know, that's always debatable with people, but I've studied it, and I think I know what I'm talking about with the martial arts factor. But what we can do is learn from that, Doug. The Japanese are great people today. I really want them on my side if I go to war, actually, because they're not only great people, but they still have that Bushido mentality. And we need to learn some things about nobody ever wins a war, just one side loses more than the other, because we're going to get whacked, and we're going to lose a lot of young men and women. And, you know, it's just, and we know for a fact, Doug, when you go to another man's country, you go over there to fight a bad man, but even the good people get mad at you. They don't want you there. After a while, they want you to go back home. And we've made that mistake in the Middle East of being there for 25 years, over 25 years. And now I don't know who the enemy and who the friends are, because they don't want us there anymore. And so we have to learn when to go and when to come back home again. That would be part of the solution.
Well, I think one thing that was scary with World War II and Pearl Harbor, and they talk about it in the history books and in the documentaries that have been on there, as soon as that happened, I mean, the number of Japanese that were all rounded up and then put in internment camps in California and all over, I mean, it was scary. And it was real funny, and I'm not sure how many the Germans were, but you have to remember very few of us were maybe one or two generations out of Germany that we were now Americans. And you had Japanese fighting Japanese, and you had Americans that were fighting their relatives just like during the American Civil War. I mean, history's got to be, it replaces itself and all this stuff, but we got to learn from it. We got to move forward, and we got to work together. I think that's the key, isn't it?
I mean, that's where the solution is, Doug.
Okay, well, thank you, Ray, again. Interesting conversation, education, information. Guys, gather for yourself, make decisions, and make a difference to make this a better world. Because, as we all said, peace begins with each of us. Let's do it. God bless you, and thank you. Thanks, Ray.